You've tuned in to Mythbehaving, a podcast where we get up close and personal with today's most imaginative authors. Every episode, we'll be sitting down with a new writer to discuss their magical worlds, futuristic visions, and how they bring their wildest ideas to the page. Moseying in from my previous partner in hosting today is the fantastic Jen Nixon. Jen, how you doing today?
I'm great. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing all right. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. It's here. December. Did you know that?
Shut the front door. December.
I know.
Yeah. It actually dropped down to the high 40s last night.
Ooh,
for us. So that is chilly.
Yeah. That is that. Well, it's about 43 right here and
right
rainy.
Now,
so
during,
yeah,
during
right,
the
yeah,
day.
Right. Yeah, right here. Well, it's 8:30 here on the East Coast, and you're on the West Coast, so we got the whole coast covered.
Oh,
great.
Yeah, we are coast to coast. So
I love it. So who do we have on the podcast today?
I am so excited to introduce today Noah Chin. Noah writes genre fiction such as fantasy and science fiction, including the sci-fi adventure comedy Lost Souls and its soon-to-be-released sequel Lost Cargo, the paranormal romantic comedy A Goddamned Love Story, and the mind-twisting Trooper Number 4 about a woman who wakes up in a motel at the end of the world, and things only get stranger from there. As a published cartoonist and writer, Noah's work has appeared in the distinguished publications including Amazing Stories, Knights of the Dinner Table magazine, and Canada's Globe and Mail. He and his wife and their ferret now live in Vancouver. He wears a hat. Jen, Noah Chin.
Woohoo, Noah!
How are you doing today, Noah?
Welcome. Just fine. Hey, howdy.
I love ferrets. I had ferrets when I was a kid, too. What's your ferret's name?
This one's Fia. We had one before named Dora.
Dora. I remember Dora.
Dora the Explorer.
Yeah, oh, I remember.
I watched a lot of Dora the Explorer in my time.
That's one I skipped over that one.
I had three boys, and they loved Dora. And the other guy, what was his name? I can't remember.
Caillou? Oh, her friend.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Her friend. He had his own spinoff, and now I can't remember. They're all going to kill
Diego?
Me.
Diego.
Diego. Yeah, go, Diego. Go, Diego, go. That was it.
That's great. We've
gone down to kids shows here.
Hey, I still watch kids shows. You know, hey, as long as the writing is good, I will watch anything.
That is so true. If the writing's good, I'm in. I'm so in. Like my youngest is watching Gravity Falls. Oh my gosh, that show is amazing.
You know, Gravity Falls to me, it's not even a kid show. Kids can watch it, but you look at that humor, it's definitely aimed at people like us because it's mostly aimed at stuff we grew up with.
Right.
That's how
that's
I feel
a
about
really
Teen
good
Titans Go.
Yeah, Teen Titans Go. Holy
it's
cow.
The same thing. Same thing. It's for kids because it's a cartoon, but all the jokes are for me.
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty there for the kids to love, of course, but there's so much that the kids just won't get that we're laughing our heads off at. I mean, Gravity Falls is probably one of the best cartoons I've seen in a while.
It's amazing, isn't it? That's funny that we stumbled into this. It's amazing. I'm all about it every time. I'm like, great, we can watch Gravity Falls. Noah, what are you watching?
Oh, it's, something I was prepared to think about.
What are you watching that inspires you?
Well, most recently, what's inspired me as far as what I'm writing goes is, science fiction shows like The Expanse.
Oh, love it.
I got totally obsessed with that when it was on. And that's one of those shows that where I started off with the show and ended up reading the books and loving both for almost different reasons, even though the same people were involved with them.
Mm-hmm. No, nice. I find just personally, that's my favorite way to do it is watch the show and then read the books. The books, if you do it the other way, you're really disappointed in everything they did.
Well, in some ways with The Expanse, it's more like they're taking the same story, but taking two different points of view from it. The show to me was very much character focused. You got a lot more focused on the characters, whereas in the books, I feel there was a lot more focused on the plot and the world building in many ways.
Right. And how does that feed into your own writing?
Well, not just from that, but also from other shows, like, for example, Star Trek Lower Decks.
Oh, my God.
Love it.
You're hitting all our buttons.
Yeah, well, that's why he's here, because I knew it. I knew it.
Because a show like Lower Decks reminds you that you can have science fiction that is still good science fiction, but can still be really funny. I mean,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. No. Yes, I was agreeing.
Oh yeah. It's like they remind you that the stakes are still there. There's still, you know, risk and all that. It's not just goofy fun, although there's a lot of goofy fun in it. But you care about the characters and you're worried about the consequences. And we don't have enough of that out there. I think the Orville did a pretty good job of that too.
Yes. Totally love the Orville. I'm so upset it's not coming back.
Yeah, I just heard that bad news too.
Yeah, I didn't watch that Inside of You yet, but that's all. He's a great interviewer, Michael Rosenbaum from Smallville. He's fantastic.
Yeah, so shows like The Expanse or Firefly, and then you look at shows like The Orville and Lower Decks, and I look at those and I think, you know what? What if you put your hands together? What would you get? And that's kind of where the inspiration for my Get Lost trilogy is coming from right now. I wanted to have that small crew, private ship, trying to get by, you know, getting jobs and getting by day to day, mixed in with the, you know, the humor of something like the Orville or Lower Decks, where things aren't exactly taken seriously, even though the stakes can be pretty high.
Right. Nice. And is it hard to inject humor into writing? Because I mean, I think I'm a funny person in general, but it's very hard to write funny.
I'm not sure. Maybe I'm just a snarky kind of person by nature or something. I don't know, but I don't find it that difficult. If anything, it just sort of flows naturally for when you have the scenario and you're just looking for, how would somebody react to this in a non-serious way? You know, you're just looking at a serious situation through a non-serious lens.
Well, that's a great way to look at it. Never thought about it that way.
So do you think you have to be snarky in order to write snark? Like, is that the requirement?
No. I mean, I was just saying that, but it's like some of my characters are definitely snarky, but other ones aren't. Some are very blindly, you know, optimistic and positive in nature. Others just don't take things seriously. And some are real downers that just look at the world and just see themselves as the victim within the galaxy, you know, grinded under the galaxy's boot heel. And that character is probably my favorite.
Why is that?
Well, he's just, we all have that part inside of us. We all, like, there are days where we always feel that the galaxy is against us, that, you know, you're going down the street and the light, just when it should have been green, it turns red on you. And you're like, oh, typical, you know, and that's just a little thing. But those little things add up and you start thinking that everything's out to get you. You know, during your good days, you don't feel that way. But there's days where it just feels like nothing's going right and everything's against you. And there is humor to find in that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
No, absolutely. No, I'm always reminded of Captain Kirk in Undiscovered Country, when he finally gets back on the Enterprise and they give him the report and he's like, it's always something. That's how I see it. It's always something.
Yep.
Actually, from that same movie, I was thinking more along the lines of when he gets transported up from Rura Pente from the escape. And the very first thing is like, he was just about to tell us the plan. What's going on? And it's like, do you want us to beam you back down? No.
It was very cold. No, that's great. But
in many ways,
that,
that epitomizes the kind of humor I'm talking about, because every time Moss feels like things are going well, something throws him a curveball.
Do you feel it's your writer's duty to do that to characters?
Well, it really depends. I mean, I am one of those writers who believes that once you know a character well enough, they start writing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I always love, there's a story from J. Michael Straczynski about Babylon 5, where he talked about how one of the characters, he was having a hard time figuring out who was going to kill the Mad King Cartaja. And he knew logically it should be one particular character, Londo, but it just didn't quite sit right with him. And one time he was having a shower and he could just hear one of the other characters whisper into his ear, you know, "It's me, I did it." And it was like the most unlikely character that you would expect to do something like that, you know, the very sweet guy, Vir Koto, but oh no, spoilers for a 30-year-old show.
Show's been out 25 years, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
like maybe it's okay, but no, that's I got to know, because that happens to me. When I'm in the shower, I don't know what it is about the shower. When I'm in the shower, dialogue flows, problems get solved. I don't, that happened to both of you, either of you, just me?
Used to be when I walked my dog. That's when I would get, that would get my stuff, like just go for a walk outside, not doing something. So I don't walk the dog anymore, but.
Exactly. It's whatever happens to clear your head to allow, you know, it drowns out the noise and lets the ideas kind of slip back in. I mean, Stephen King also would do that as well. He'd get his ideas by going out for a walk. And then he got hit by a van.
But then he wrote it into the book. So
therapeutic as well.
Yeah, there you go.
Came all that he wrote himself into the Gunslinger series. I was like, is that really Steve? Yeah, when this happened. I know about this.
He definitely went meta on that.
Oh my gosh, that becomes the most meta series. Yeah.
And nothing wrong with that. I like a good meta, although sometimes I think it gets a little overplayed, kind of the way multiverses, I think, are getting a bit overplayed right now. Every gosh darn thing is a multiverse, it seems.
Yeah, I miss the days when Fringe just had a parallel universe and that was it.
That was it. Just the one.
Just the Fringe one and that was it.
Yeah, I like Fringe. That wasn't a bad show. Yeah.
I love that show. I've done a three full rewatches of that one.
I just felt the last season was a little bit.
It had a good
wrap up. I like how it tied everything together. It gave closure.
But it was not. I skipped most of those episodes. I did not like it either. But the beginning, the first season was fantastic. Yeah, it was a good show.
But I mean, there's something to be said. So many shows don't get a chance to have proper closure. So I appreciate any show that actually has the chance to do so.
Yes,
especially where they do it right, and that I think that doesn't happen often enough. I think I think money gets in the way of, you know, where they had an idea, a vision of where the show would close, and then they're like, but what if we did three more seasons and paid you lots of money?
Yeah. And then, like, and the ones that get cut off too soon, it's like one season. And these days, the trend seems to be, you know, you have a good, strong season, but the problem is it didn't make all the money.
Right.
It made money, but not all the money. Yeah. Right. And therefore, it gets canceled.
Yeah.
Right. Which is why I'm not watching any new shows until they get a season two. So
or they get canceled.
That new show on NBC, Found, with Mark Paul Gosselaar, just got renewed for season two, and everybody was talking about it. So I decided to watch it. It's pretty good. Not sci-fi, but it's pretty good.
That's good to hear.
So I have a question. You write in a lot of different genres. Is your favorite genre to write in the same as you prefer to read in?
Yes and no. It's funny because I don't find enough science fiction comedy out there. The one exception being Harry Harrison, I believe his name is, Stainless Steel Rat series.
You're reaching way back. Yeah, this is
and that's the problem. I'm reaching way back. I did have somebody actually compare my Get Lost series to Harry Harrison, which was like a great compliment because
he's
pretty funny. He's kind of like a proto Terry Pratchett in some ways.
Yeah,
nice.
No. Now that you bring it up, I see exactly that comparison with your work. And oh my gosh, I'm having shades of High School. my buddies and I read those series. I'm sorry. Anyhow, go ahead with your answer.
Oh, no, I was just saying that, like, he's sort of like a proto Terry Pratchett because his character of the Stainless Steel Rat Point reminds me a lot of Moist von Lipwig from his later books. Mm-hmm. You know, just that con artist guy that is kind of bored with the world and is trying to keep things interesting in his own way.
Yeah, that was that series. Oh my gosh. I'm just going to fanboy on that series now for the rest of the show. Just blah, blah, blah.
Do you know they did a Choose Your Own Adventure set in that?
Shut up. No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was doing some research on him a while back, looking at his bibliography, and I noticed it. One of there was a Choose Your Own Adventure type story where you get to be, you are the Stainless Steel Rat.
That's awesome. Would you want to do one of those? Would you want to do a Choose Your Own?
Well, I am a game master. I play a lot of role-playing games. I guess it's not that different, but I don't know. I think I'd rather stick with just doing the actual role-playing. The problem with choose your own adventure is you're just limited in your branches, right? You can only have so many choices. And when you're role-playing, there's infinite choices.
No, that's very true. One of my favorite authors, S. Andrew Swan, he did a choose your own on the ebook. It was great, but I because I follow him, he was complaining. He said he had to write almost three times the content for the book.
Wow.
Because of the branches, you know, so many, he could only do so many branches, but even then, three times the content. I was like, holy cow. And very limited scope of people who are going to read it.
Even for a short story, that'd be crazy. Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah. And given my output, that would be horrible. So, yeah.
Wow. And then imagine having to do that for a TV show or a movie, because Netflix, I think, did a couple of movies that were basically video choose your own adventures. They would have had to film so much stuff for that.
Oh my god. Yep,
they did Bandersnatch, which was a Black Mirror one, and then I saw this romance one, which was really weird. But
was it Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt?
No. Yes. I think it was maybe that girl from it. She was cute, like cute little elf girl. But it was like three different boys, and you had to pick which one. So I went back and picked all three of them, and just to watch all the endings, just because I'm weird. So yeah, I did the same thing with Bandersnatch and went back and played it again, went back, played it again.
Yeah.
Gotta see all the endings. You're gonna give me five endings. I wanna see them all.
Yeah, you wanna see it all. Yeah.
I grew up playing video games. I wanna see all the endings.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
This episode of Myth Behaving is brought to you by the Bath Bomb Diva, producing fine, handcrafted bath bombs and shower steamers. Scents ranging from fruits to florals to musks and more. In observation of Mariah Carey's annual teeth-gnashing, mouth-foaming rampage through modern civilization, the Diva offers up new holiday goodness with fizzy, fragrant bath salts and bubble bath bomb hot tubs. These great stocking stuffers made with wonderful scents such as warm vanilla sugar, sugar cookie, and comfort and joy. What does comfort and joy smell like? Beats me. But they all include small toy surprises like bendable figures, flashing LED light cubes, and cool toy erasers that are sure to delight. 4 out of 5 people randomly surveyed at my house show that even the most stubborn anti-bather will absolutely look forward to jumping into a tub made wondrous and magical by the Bath Bomb Diva. Thanks, as always, to Bath Bomb Diva for being a valued sponsor to the show.
Okay, you know, every writer has to be asked the question, pantser or plotter?
Oh, definitely a pantser.
Ah.
Tiny little plotter, like a little bit of a plotter, but mostly a pantser for sure. When people ask me about, if they come and ask about how to be a writer, I always refer them to Stephen King's novel, On Writing, Memoir of the Craft.
Yeah.
Right. And that speaks to me as a pantser.
Oh, that's funny.
Because in that book, he talks about how he's plotted a few books, but most of the time, you know, he's just doing it as he goes along.
Right. And he says, write all the way through. Don't go back. Just write all the way through, because you can always edit when you're done. But if you just do 10 pages, then you have 10 pages of well edited and no book.
Yeah.
And I totally see where he's coming from, but I can't go to that extreme. My ADHD will not allow me to.
So you've got to go back and correct things.
Yeah, I mean, I have to go back and I reread it over, and the editor in me ends up having to do some on the spot editing. But I think that gives me time to think about what comes next.
I'm exactly the same way. I read everything I wrote the day before, usually everything, edit it while I'm going, fix all my typos, because half the time I'm out of my mind when I'm writing, and then I go. And sometimes I just keep reading, and I don't write. That's part of the problem of being a pantser.
It is one of the problems for sure. Sometimes it's just you get stuck in a particular position, and it's like you're staring at the screen for half an hour, and then the bell goes off to tell you it's time to take a break.
Yeah.
Like, what break? I haven't done anything yet.
Right. It's time for chocolate milk. That's my chocolate milk break. Time for chocolate milk. I've been writing in quotes for 30 minutes.
In quotes, exactly. Yeah. Still counts. Still counts, because your brain's still working the problem.
That's right. Yeah. What do you treat yourself with, Noah?
What you mean, like if I've had a really good day of writing?
Yeah.
Sleep.
Oh, nice. Full 8 hours, or do you just, yes. you know?
More like a nap, really, yeah. you know?
That's nice. Do you listen to music or, you know, have anything on in the background while you're writing?
Well, I do have some like lo-fi jazz, one of those type of YouTube channels on where I'm doing it because I mentioned ADHD earlier. And even though I'm not officially diagnosed, I am fairly confident I do suffer from ADHD. Mm-hmm. And so rather than I'm not going to bother, I don't want to necessarily go on to any kind of medication for it, but I was thinking, you know what? I should at the very least look at the advice for how people deal with it because it's darn good advice in its own right.
Right.
So various tricks in terms of keeping your attention going involves background music, some kind of white noise or something to keep you focused. So I do find that helps. I'm using Pomodoro as well for the same reason, which is why I mentioned the timer.
Mm. Ah.
That's and overall it works. I mean, you know, just having some, just some kind of music, as long as there's no lyrics, because once there's lyrics on there, my brain's locking onto what they're trying to say.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, I find the same thing. I might be a little ADHD myself, but I find the same thing. If I'm going to put music on, it can't have lyrics because next thing I know, I'm singing to the lyrics and it's not writing.
Yeah.
I've or you end that. Up writing those lyrics down right, on right your page. How did that get in there?
Yeah. Yeah. That's how Billy Idol's, Rebel Yell got into a story. It was on. Like, yeah, this rules.
This worked. This totally fits exactly the scene I'm writing right
Billy
now.
Billy gets it. Yeah, Billy gets it. No, a lot of authors, famously like George R. R. Martin, he writes on this really archaic program. I'm curious what you write on. Do you write on Word? Do you write in Grammarly? Do you write in whatever the other ones are?
Well, a roundabout question on that, because I write on all of them. I use a Word for my first drafts, mm-hmm. and I've got a program called Atticus that I use for formatting,
mm-hmm.
and I've got Grammarly to help me with the, you know, the first wave, like the editing and typos and stuff like that, even as I go.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as what I type on, I'm afraid now I'm back to an ordinary keyboard, but I used to love it. I have an old... Royal Quiet Deluxe typewriter.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Now, what I had done with it though is that you can go to a website that gives you kits that allow you to turn that typewriter into a USB keyboard.
Oh, wow.
Without damaging the typewriter.
That's
it will actually still work just fine as a typewriter, but you can then, you know, type away on your type away on the keyboard and it'll show up on your screen. And I wrote a couple of books that way, and it just loving the feel of the pounding of the keys and all that.
Right,
I like
right.
the yeah. sound of the.
Yeah,
that's cool.
My wife hates the sound if she's too close by.
Of course, yeah.
Fortunately, I tend to do it when she's in the other room, so it's not so bad. But unfortunately, I got to repair my keyboard, so I'm back to an ordinary 101 key type keyboard.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of Atticus. What do you think about that program?
I find it extremely useful for a self-publisher because it allows you to get everything looking exactly the way you want, both in ebook format and for the print. All of the books that I've published so far have been made using Atticus, and it's quite frankly probably one of the best things a self-publisher could use, in my opinion. They're increasing their functionality so you can more and more use it mm-hmm. as your word processor if you so choose.
Right.
And they're splatting features as well.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of those. Like Grammarly, when it first came out, was really, really what it said. It was just for grammar. Like it'll help you with grammar. But now they're adding more and more features where I've heard writers are like, no, this is so much better than Word. And I'm like, how can you give up on Word ever?
Yeah.
I'm so ingrained into Word. I love it so much. But
I still use it as my primary. I mean, yeah. I could use Atticus for doing my first draft, but mm-hmm. yeah, I'm too ingrained in using Word. It's like, that's just where I get my ideas out. And mm-hmm. then when it comes to polishing, I'll move it over to Atticus.
You just plug it in. That's awesome. That's great advice. I love it.
Yeah. And being an editor, you've obviously edited a lot of different books. So I have a question that I've been wanting to ask an editor, and it's a bad question to ask, but I have to ask it anyway. When you're editing a book and either A, you don't like the book, the story, whatever, the characters, or B, the writing is so bad, how do you push through it?
Okay, so let me start off by saying that what I edit most tend to be romance novels.
Mm.
I am not a romance reader.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started working for a company called Sawin down in the States, that they're a romance company, so I was working with romance authors exclusively. Part of me thought I was going to die a little bit inside because of that.
Remember, I am a romance writer here.
Oh, yeah. But it was
that... No, I'm just kidding. I know.
But it was actually the best thing that could have happened to me, because in doing that, I learned a very important lesson. And that is that all stories have merit.
Mm-hmm.
Even a Harlequin romance, your cheesiest cliche Harlequin romance, has merit. You just have to know where to look for it. Mm-hmm. So... Right. When I'm dealing with stories that aren't in my niche or aren't my taste, I just ask myself the question of looking for, where is the real message in this story, and try and help the author bring it out. So that actually is really satisfying on my end, and often gets very appreciated by my writers. Now, the other part of your question about when something's written really bad, that's a whole other issue. Mm-hmm. In that case, I try to just look at myself as a teacher. Like, I've had a few, I fortunately don't have to deal with this too often, but when I do have to deal with a writer who is clearly not ready for publishing, I will do the job as required. But throughout the whole thing, it might take a little longer, but I see myself shepherding a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I'm just going to give you some advice as I go along here about what to do to make you a better writer.
Mm-hmm.
There was only one case, though, where I had a writer who was absolutely not ready for prime time, and I had to just sort of break that to her in the sense of suggesting a complete rewrite. I suggested Stephen King's On Writing, like, read this first, mm-hmm. and then try again. Mm-hmm. Actually, she was not too disappointed by that. I think she was kind of feeling it herself, but she wanted to get out there, and I kept the praise going as well, mm-hmm. where she's doing things right. And
awesome.
I guess you could say the best tool that I use as an editor is humor.
Mm-hmm.
It's one, well, like everyone talks about the cliche about writers who are very protective of their work. Don't touch what I've written. You know, my baby, the divas out there. I've only really had one diva mm-hmm. that I've had to edit for. Most of them are open to criticism, and it helps if you can take that criticism and put it in the form of humor to help point out the flaw without seeming like you're being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
If you can use that and sort of twist it around, and it's like makes them go, not only laugh, but go, oh, I see where you're coming from, then they're all the more likely to actually take that advice.
Right.
Right.
Great answer. I love that answer.
I remember my first book came back, and a friend of mine actually was the editor for it. And, it just felt like I was being piled on and piled on. And I was like I called her up and I said, Sean, do you just hate me? She's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, all these Aww. Edits. She's like, no, I don't hate you. Why would I hate you? I'm like, it's so much. She's like, well, no, I'm just hitting all the key points as I go through. It has nothing to do with your, oh, I get it, because I'm reading them all at once. It feels like criticism, but it's not. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, to cope with that, anytime I get a new writer come to me with mm-hmm. a, that I've never worked with before, I actually have sort of a standard operating procedure email that I send that explains to them what I do, how I do it, so that they're ready for that. They don't get that kind of shock.
Yeah, good. That sounds good.
That's a great way to do it. Yeah, it was a great answer. And you're right. Everybody is bad in the beginning, and we all can grow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can't all be Shakespeare, but, we could probably all be Stephen King if we really tried.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He himself calls himself the burger and fries of literature.
Right, right. No, he's
great. I got nothing wrong with that. I'll be happy with burger and fries.
Yeah, exactly. Like that, that's a problem I'd like to have,
Yeah, exactly.
Where you're so good that whatever you put your name on, they just back a truck of cash up and here, take it.
I'm strictly talking about the quality of writing here. I mean, mm-hmm. the marketing, that's a whole other nightmare, especially for the self-publisher.
And what do you do for marketing right now?
What I can, what I can.
What we all do, right? Pray a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've tried a little bit of everything, advertising on Facebook and BookBub and trying to build up my newsletter and Goodreads, all those kind of things. I've gone through various courses. I don't know if you've ever mentioned David Goldgren. He has a course called Starting from Zero, which is a lot of the writers that I've worked with have recommended stuff like that, that where you can actually get advice about where to go if you've never done any kind of marketing at all.
Right.
Did you happen to look at, what is it, 20 for 50 or whatever that is called? I haven't. I'm just aware of it.
No, I hadn't heard of that one.
That's the premise is that you get 20 books written and you should be able to earn $50,000 a year off of that, which is a great premise. I just don't know how real that is. But
so I think they would, I can't help but feel like that might need to go under, you know, fairy tale or something like that.
Well, I think it, yeah. Or if you have, you know, 25 grand to spend on advertising, then yeah, sure, you can make $50,000.
Yeah,
no problem.
There's the problem.
Your money.
Yeah. I mean, having that base investment to get up to there is another question entirely.
Yeah, I think that's something a lot of new writers don't really understand when they go into it, that especially indie or small press, that you're now the marketing company. So now you have a second job in addition to writing and whatever your day job is, if you want that book to do anything more than just friends and family.
Exactly. Although I will say, when it said 20 to 50, and when you mentioned that, I can see where he's coming from that, because it's not about your first few books. It's about building up a series until you get to a point where you get people that not only a fan base that was with you from the beginning, but as new people come in, they go back to your earlier stuff. I mean, the old saying, the best way to sell a new book, or the best way to sell an old book is to write a new
write
one.
A new one.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm at 19, so I guess I got one more book.
Look at you
to
go. I'm so jealous. That's awesome.
And of course, whatever I'm making here, I've on my current books, I've putting into a separate account, which I'm then funneling back into a marketing fund, as opposed to just, you know, trying to think of that as profit. It's not profit yet.
Yeah.
It's more, it's future marketing funds.
Right. Right. That's exactly how I look at it too. Roll it over. Keep rolling it over. Someday we're going to hit the jackpot, right? Let it ride.
Yeah, exactly.
Noah, in your own writing, what would you say is the biggest risk you've taken?
Pass.
Oh, good one. Nice.
Sorry. I honestly don't know how to answer that one. Define what you mean by risk in this particular case.
Like I we can go back on this, but I just think about some of the stuff that I've done and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try this. And it panned out. And I was like, oh, that's fantastic. Like, I always consider myself a genre fiction writer. So sci-fi and mostly fantasy. But someone approached me and said, hey, could you write something horror? And I'm like, no, I don't know what horror is. I don't know how to write horror. But he kept pestering. I'm like, fine, I'll write horror. And I ended up like not really with a horror, but I ended up with a great character that was like, oh, I could do more with this character. This is fantastic. So that risk really paid off for me.
Well, I guess I could have two answers for that then. One would be drawing upon my own family dynamic to create a story. Now, that actually sort of seems like what everyone does. Everyone writes what they know. But in my case, it was kind of like, so I wrote a murder mystery without a murder. And I wanted to involve my entire extended family in this in a allegorical sense almost. You know, not for one for one or anything like that, but the sort of thing where you're just sort of using the basis of an idea, because one member of my family had been quite the jerk to others. And I just thought, you know what? What if you had it so that somebody got so angry at this guy, they shipped him off to Peru. And then it's like a question of trying to figure out who in the family did it. And this whole extended family is like based around a matriarch who had had a very large family. And I just sort of loosely based it on things that had happened. But then there was another story. It's actually the one book that I co-wrote. I co-wrote a story called Across the Stars with a romance author, Lauren Smith. And that was her first attempt at doing a science fiction romance. She normally deals with historical romance, so this was definitely out of her comfort zone. And it kind of showed, because when she had written it, You ever read a story era and it just sort of feels like the world building is something that was just made up as it went along?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So the first draft of this felt like that. And so I talked about it with her. She sent me the pages she had for her world building, which is about 3 pages of notes about the various races and what's going on. Mm-hmm. And within about a week, I turned it into 30. Just to try and expand on the ideas that she had to build out, flesh out that world more, and then take that and apply it to the future edits. And ended up editing it enough that she agreed to make me the co-author on it. Nice. And that same universe is the universe that I'm using in for my Get Lost series.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it just seemed like a fun enough place that I wanted to see where else I could go with it.
Very nice. And is that out now or is that coming out?
Across the Stars has been around for a couple years now. Okay. The Lost Souls came out in January and mm-hmm. Lost Cargo actually just got released last month. I guess I got to
update. Oh, we got to update your bio.
Yeah, it's just I got to update my bio apparently.
Noah, it's been so great to have you on. You've been a wonderful guest. I'm going to ask one more question before we wrap up. I want to know, when you're working with younger writers, or at least, you know, I'm going to say immature writers, how do you teach them to be confident in their writing?
Well, honestly, you can't really teach them. It's like you need to more like be a map and a compass and let them find their own way. Mm-hmm. So I would point out, for example, all of the golden chestnuts out there, like kill all the adverbs and stuff like that. Yeah. But when it comes to the rest, it's more like just encouraging them to keep at it and keep reading, keep writing, and they'll find their own way. But you can always sort of give them the basics so that they don't come across as sounding amateurish, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's exactly perfect. That's a great message to end on, that that idea of you got to keep at it. But yeah, definitely. Compass and map. I love it. That's great. Well, Jen, we've done it again. Another author that we've interviewed. No, it was so great to have you on. We would love to have you back again.
Oh, it was great to be here. And I'd love to give it another shot.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It was great having an editor's perspective this time. I like that change.
Yeah, we'll dive into that a little more next time. Jen, I hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
It's always good to talk to you. And tune in next time on Mythic.